Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Recently, a listener wrote us an email accusing us of being Luddites. Amusing as I sit here surrounded by broadcast equipment and computer. We do, however, use our equipment prudently. Everything is wired. We keep our little AC converters as far from our bodies as possible and turn everything off when we're done using it. We keep all equipment isolated in our offices and away from our living and sleeping space. I love equipment, but I also love the quiet of not having it around all the time. Today we explore what epidemiology can tell us about the contribution that electricity has made to our health. So much depends on how it's delivered and whether other delivered frequencies are nearby to interfere with it and the Earth's native ground. Although we're surrounded by natural forms of electromagnetic energy, the sharp increase of these new artificial pulsed frequencies coincides with a marked increase in the amount of serious chronic diseases appearing in young people. Learn how to protect yourself and your children. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, PhD.
Thank you, Lena. The campaign of fear against hormone replacement therapy entered a new phase last week. A few years ago, results from the Women's Health Initiative were heavily advertised in the mainstream media. That campaign caused women and their doctors to flee from not only the conventional hormone therapy that was studied, but from all hormone use. The conclusion was that postmenopausal women on hormone replacement therapy were at greater risk of breast cancer. As I commented at the time, the study failed miserably for a variety of reasons, two chief among them. First, and most importantly, the researchers were generalizing from the use of one drug, Prempro, that is not chemically the same as the estrogen and progesterone a woman's body produces, and so would not be expected to have the same biological effect. Second, the design of the study was sloppy about such matters as the actual hormone needs of each woman. The latest campaign is based on results from the same long-term study that show that women on Prempro are not only more likely to suffer breast cancer, but that any cancer that develops is likely to be more deadly. Not by a lot, mind you, but statistically more deadly. The reasons for ignoring this alarm remain the same. All they really tell us is, don't take Prempro. It's not much of a stretch to say that women should avoid hormone therapy using pharmaceuticals as well. But it says absolutely nothing about use of bioidentical estrogen and progesterone. Everyone involved with this research concludes that the study requires caution with all hormones. That conclusion is based on a false premise, which is that the side effects of a pharmaceutical that imitates an actual hormone can be reasonably assumed to apply to the hormone itself. This is clearly an absurd conclusion based on faulty logic. If the hormone posed the same risks as the pharmaceutical, one would expect similar risks of breast cancer among premenopausal women whose hormones are in the same balance as those of the postmenopausal women taking the pharmaceutical. That, of course, is not true. On the other hand, there's a strong case for assuming that the pharmaceutical, in fact, would have a different biological effect as compared to the actual hormone. The crude way of putting it is that, as far as a woman's body is concerned, the pharmaceutical is a toxin because it's not recognizable as native to the woman's biology. The reason for the chemical difference is financial. In order for the pharmaceutical to be patented, its molecular structure must be different from the actual naturally occurring hormone. As a chemical, Prempro can't be the same as the estrogen and progesterone a woman's body produces. Another way to look at this is that the pharmaceutical is an endocrine disruptor that has been developed, patented, and prescribed to postmenopausal women. Endocrine disruptors are one of a wide variety of toxins to which we are exposed. In the current issue of Science, Stephen Rappaport and Martin Smith of UC Berkeley's School of Public Health discuss the need to increase our understanding of what they call the exposome. Study of the genome is about how genes affect human biology. Study of the exposome is about how environmental exposures affect human biology. Rappaport and Smith argue that although genome research gets much of the attention and funding, it is the exposome, that is, environmental exposures, that are predominantly at the root of the chronic diseases that plague us. However, the current methodological state of the art for uncovering the causal relationships between environment and disease are weak. The most significant weakness in this research is that it tends to focus on one kind of exposure and one disease. For example, the relationship between exposure to an endocrine disruptor such as bisphenol A and thyroid function. Yet it is commonly accepted that the relationship between environmental exposures and disease is not one-to-one, but many-to-many. In order to understand those relationships, a project on the scale of the Human Genome Project is required. In other words, a human exposome project. Pharmaceuticals are in the human exposome. How much? Between 1999 and 2008, the number of people taking five or more pharmaceuticals almost doubled, from 6.3% to 10.7% of the population. The number taking two or more pharmaceuticals increased from a quarter of the population to a third. It's an experiment in drug interactions with occasional lip service and little research. More importantly, it is part of a larger experiment of which we are a part, the experiment that subjects us, largely involuntarily, to biologically active environmental exposures. Personally, I don't think the experiment has turned out very well. While the Human Exposome Project gets off the ground, I think it's wise to cool it on the experiments. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to today's topic and guest. Our show today is about epidemiology and electrosmog, and we'll be talking with Dr. Samuel Milhound, M-I-L-H-A-M. Milhound is a physician epidemiologist specializing in public health. He has more than 100 scientific publications, many dealing with the health effects of electricity. In 1997, Dr. Milhelm was awarded the Ramassini Prize for his pioneering work in describing the occupational cancer risks of electromagnetic fields. He lives in Olympia, Washington, and Indio, California, with his wife, Sherry, and his dog, Monte. Welcome, Dr. Milhelm.
Hi.
Hi. So you may have to speak up ever so slightly. It sounds like your phone's a little bit quiet.
I'm quiet.
There you go. Okay. So as an epidemiologist, you examined or have examined disease clusters, and you look for correlations to find the cause. How did you get into looking at the way electricity can become a serious irritant?
Well, if it's partly accidental and partly methodological, When I first started working in the field, my first job was at the New York State Health Department.
Sam?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to ask you to, despite the fact that I need you to talk louder, to speak not directly into your receiver, because you've got one of those really breathy receivers, so you're coming out sounding sissy and, you know, going popping your peas and stuff. So if you could.
I'll hold it at a distance and see if that's it.
That's much better, yeah.
Okay, well, my first job was in the early 60s in New York State Health Department, and one of the first papers, you read the literature, one of the first papers I read was in The Lancet by Court Brown and Dahl, Sir Richard Dahl, who did the lung cancer epidemiology, and it was a remarkable paper showing that out of nowhere, an age peak, childhood leukemia mortality, had emerged in the UK in the 20s and in the US in the 60s and the 30s rather. Now at that time all childhood leukemia was fatal, so death records were a good way to count them. So they just basically looked at single year of age in these kids who died of leukemia and noticed that say in 1910, 1920 you had a nice flat curve. The numbers dying at age 1, 2, 3, and 4, and 5 were pretty much the same.
That's really young.
Yeah, but the thing that's amazing is that starting in the 20s there and in the 30s here, a big peak emerged at age 2 through 4. And the other thing about that peak that was amazing is it's all one type of leukemia. It's common acute lymphoblastic leukemia. When I saw that, I said to myself, boy, if we follow this up, here's something new happened. And if we can trace it down, we'll be able to understand what's causing this disease. Well, I was right, but it took me 40 years to finally figure it out. So that's how it started for me. I've been obsessed with childhood leukemia ever since that paper in the 60s. And shortly thereafter, I studied a cluster of leukemia in the central part of New York State using the death records. I just actually went to a card count sorter. In those days, there weren't computers, and I sorted all the death cards for leukemia. And I got a real cluster in a central New York county that's centered in Rome, New York, near Utica. And I visited the houses and talked to the families. And a couple of things were interesting. The mother of one of the kids also died of leukemia. This had happened 10 years before I found it. But many years later, Smigelski, a Polish investigator, reported that men who worked with radar in the Polish military or with microwaves had increased leukemia and lymphoma. And I just remembered clearly that when I was walking around in Rome, New York, visiting these families, that most of the houses were within line of sight of a big radar array at Griffiths Air Force Base, which isn't there anymore. But, you know, when I did this study, I had no clue that electricity or radar or anything else could cause cancer. So that was the second hit on electricity. And then when I turned up at Washington State, before I left New York, I did a study of a cancer called Hodgkin's disease, and I used a death record occupational statement to look for potential occupational associations with this cancer, and we found that it seemed to be much more common in people who work with wood. But then when I had a short tour in the University of Hawaii where I replicated the Hodgkin's study and found the same thing in West Coast death records where there's a lot more woodworkers in Washington and Oregon, then I took my last job at the Washington Health Department, and I was so excited about being able to exploit the death record occupational statement that I just sat down for a year with my secretary, and we coded all the deaths in men initially over age 20 and coded their occupation. And basically, it was a fishing expedition. This had been done just once or twice before. People in the UK, the Registrar General in the UK, does this stuff routinely. But here I actually looked at every certificate. We gave it a code number, like carpenters had 411 and electricians had 421. And what turned up with that was all the expected causes and associations were there, like pilots die in plane crashes, electricians get electrocuted. But the one surprising new finding was that anybody who worked in a job with an intuitive connection with electricity had increased mortality from leukemia, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, brain cancer, and some other cancers.
So the reason that the woodworkers were getting more exposure was because of their tool? You mean because of their electrified tools?
No. Oh. I think the woodworkers' exposure to Hodgkin's is something in wood and paper process.
Yes.
There's a carcinogen in it.
Sure.
That causes Hodgkin's.
Right.
But so basically that study was only important in that it showed me that you could use the death record occupational statement to learn new things about occupational exposures.
Mm-hmm.
So when I looked at all of Washington State deaths from 1950 through 1950 through 1980, well, I've looked at it every 10 years ever since, but my first pass through the data showed all the expected associations, like silicosis and hard rock miners. But the surprising new association was that a list of, say, 10 or 11 categories where you knew that people had exposure to electricity, like appliance repair people, linemen,
electricians. Yes.
They all had a leukemia, acute leukemia excess, and a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma excess, and a brain cancer excess.
Right.
So that's when I really said, hey, I better focus on this electrical business, and so I started.
One of the things that makes it interesting to hear from you and to hear you, and also to read your new book. You just published a book called Dirty Electricity, Electrification and the Diseases of Civilization, is because you have such a long view. I mean, you've really been studying this for a long time. Let me just ID the show. This is Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. We're talking today with Dr. Sam Milham, M-I-L-H-A-M. He is both a physician and an epidemiologist with a background in public health. And we're discussing his book, Dirty Electricity. You know, the childhood leukemia stuff, well, let me, one of the things that makes this hard for people to understand that this is possible, there are two reasons. One is because it appears that we're all living longer and better than our ancestors. So it's very hard for people to understand how electricity and all that it affords us, all the benefits, could possibly turn against us and be unhealthy. So I want to talk about that, but I also want to say that the reason that people don't know so much about the childhood, I mean, I think people associate childhood leukemia with situations where people buy a house and there's a huge power pole in front of the house, just an enormous, with transformers and all that. So I think that there's some understanding in the population that it's better, because just judging from what happens to property values, it's better not to buy a house with an enormous power pole with transformers on it right in front of your house. That was the early thing. But the other reason that people don't know about this is because the industry has these highly paid industry experts who have destroyed all of the good research of other scientists around childhood leukemia and electrification. So do you want to talk a little bit about that first, about how...
Well, you know, you said something before about the long view. Well, yeah, I've been at this for nearly 50 years. You know, it's taken every bit of that time to put all this stuff together. I mean, if I when I retired in 1992, if I'd just gone out and fished instead of continuing with this, I would have blown all of this. I mean, here I had the occupational connection, and... Well, let's talk about childhood leukemia briefly. The disease is caused by in utero exposure.
Again, let me have you talk off the receiver a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
Childhood leukemia is caused by some sort of exposure of the fetus in utero, because kids can be born with it. There's also a chromosomal translocation that's been associated with it, and twin studies and blood spot studies. You know, when babies are born, they do a heel stick to look for so-called metabolic diseases, inborn errors of metabolism that can be treated. If you look at those blood spots from those kids who die of leukemia, they have a higher prevalence of a characteristic chromosomal translocation. So the biology of childhood leukemia is fairly clear. It happens because of some exposure of the fetus early on. Now, when I was doing the childhood leukemia studies, we looked at the literature. Once the peak developed, it wasn't homogeneous. Initially in the U.S., blacks didn't have it. They got it later. Japanese got it later. What really stuck in my craw was that kids who lived in parts of the world without electricity, they just didn't have the childhood peak, like sub-Saharan Africa, Kerala, India, places that hadn't been electrified, places that aren't electrified now, still don't have it. So there was something about electricity and childhood leukemia, so I decided, what happened is I was surfing the net one night, and I came across this graph, which I kind of knew about, but I didn't really grasp its full import. It showed the time trend of residential electrification in the United States, and it had a couple lines. One was for farms, and one was for non-farms, urban areas. And by the turn of the century, that's turn of the last century, 1900, most of the big cities in the world had electricity. It took until the mid-50s, 1955, for the U.S. farms to catch up to the cities. So you had this big period, half a century, where part of our population had residential electrification, and part didn't. When I saw that graph, I said, oh, my God, here's a chance to do a good study. I had no idea where the data came from. I emailed the author of the graph and some New York City people, and they responded right away. I said, well, this stuff, dummy, is in census data. So I looked at the census, and there it was. And And so we had census data by state showing the percent of residents in each state who had electricity, and they had urban and rural rates that you could calculate. And so we went and pulled out all the childhood leukemia deaths in the state for around the census in 1930 and 1950, and we looked at the rates of childhood leukemia by whether or not the area was electrified. What we saw was the urban areas had high rates, and the childhood peak spread according to the spread of electrification. It was a dramatic correlation. So that was just basically, you know, black and white evidence to me as an epidemiologist that there was something about electrification that caused this peak to emerge, this one kind of leukemia. And when I was doing that, I just had to look at some other causes, and I was just astonished to find that some adult cancers bore the same relationship with electrification. The first one I looked at was breast cancer, and it was like 80% correlated with residential electrification. And then the big surprise was, as I looked more and more at the other causes, they were all associated. And that got me into looking at the one population in this country that doesn't have the exposure and never has, and that's the Old Order Amish. That's a Mennonite sect, and they believe that electricity is evil, and they live in unelectrified homes and don't use electrified tools, or et cetera. And they have dramatically different cancer rates, diabetes rates, suicide rates, Alzheimer rates, and all more favorable than ours.
So let me go back to this question of people's perceptions. Now, you know, people have the perception that since we've had electricity in our homes and the conveniences that we have, which are enormous conveniences, I'm certainly not going back to washing my clothes by hitting them against rocks or doing them without a washer. I mean, we're not advocating it during this show. We're not advocating that people not use electricity. But it is also the case that the United States, and I think this is for different reasons, but I think this may be related, that the United States actually has fallen to something like 43 in the world in terms of ratings for life expectancy and child mortality. So one of the reasons that I'm concerned about this is that because I understand exactly how the information was suppressed, I even know which paid industry experts worked on the papers that were reconfigurations of really good science where they cheapened and destroyed the conclusions. So there's been a dilution of the problems, and now we find ourselves in a new world with new technologies which are increasing something which is making all electricity more dangerous. So first let's talk a little bit about the problem with these highly paid industry experts and exactly how they do what they do so that the public perception is that everything's just fine.
Well, you know, my nose first got pushed into this I think 1992, when I had the childhood leukemia study all wrapped up, ready to publish. So I sent it to American Journal of Epidemiology. I sent it to half a dozen other journals over a course of 2 or 3 years, and they refused to reject it. I mean, initially they reviewed it, but then after a while, the word must have gotten out between them not to publish this. So, you know, look, I've been part of the referee world. I've refereed 1,000 papers probably for different journals. I've refereed papers, and I expect my papers to get honest refereeing. So I sent the paper to a former editor of American Journal of Epidemiology, a friend named Janet Daling, and said, "What's wrong with this paper?" And she said, "Not a thing." She says, "It's politically challenging," and she suggested I send it to out of the country to another journal, which I did, and got published right away. And then the next thing, as I've been writing the cell phone literature, the studies, which are just a joke, and most of the studies that allege to look at the relationship between morbidity and mortality and exposure to microwaves and cell phones, they're crappy. I mean, they're just bad. They got high non-response rates, and and so I've written maybe 8 or 9 letters to the editor, which get published, but nobody knows about them, pointing out all the flaws in the studies and saying that you know, these studies aren't worth the paper they're printed on. Therefore, you can't make any health inferences about what they say. So that's the other thing that's happened. I've done quite a bit of medical legal work. People try to stop a power line. They hire me. They try to stop a cell tower or a radio station from going in. You know, I can testify from my experience over the years the potential health hazards. But I see the same retinue of industry-paid hacks who follow me around and tell lies. And the latest example of it is a woman named Lika Kaifetz. Last year, well, I think it was 2 years ago, maybe last year, too. Also, I was in contact with professors at UC San Diego about a breast cancer cluster in a literature building. And I was just ready to go over and make measurements and to sort it out when I was told not to. They went and hired Dr. Kaifetz, and she gave them a nice clean bill of health. So it's never been resolved. Here I live in winters in Indio, California, and I did a study a couple years ago of a middle school that showed this dirty electricity connection, which we can get into, but I learned of a elementary school, Vista Del Monte Elementary School, that's got a real epidemic of dirty electricity cancer. And in this case, there's a cell tower right on campus, 25 feet from classrooms. So they hired Dr. Kaifetz to write him a report, which I hope to get a copy of one of these days. And she said, there's nothing wrong, no standards are being violated, which is true. All our standards are a joke because they're based on tissue heating. And she basically convinced the school district that there's no problem at the school. And in spite of the fact that they've got a big, big excess of cancer, there's a tiny population of teachers, and they've got these cancers. And another one's in the hospital right now. Just got operated on at age 40. So, yeah. You know, this, I don't know how this woman can look herself in the mirror.
Well,
she makes lots of money.
She makes lots of money.
And she tells it's a medical legal problem. The lawyers for the school districts are dreadfully afraid of getting sued for causing cancer in the schools and the teachers and then the kids. And they advise the politicians and the people who run the school districts to fight this stuff and to stamp it out, and it'll go away. And it ain't going to go away. I mean, there's a study of California teachers done 15 years ago that shows all these cancers are great access. Why teachers, you know? I'll tell you why. It's because they're exposed to this dirty electricity, which we can get into.
Yeah, we'll do that in a second. Yeah.
Okay.
We had some experience with Lika Kaifetz because she's... She was supposed to appear at a forum that we did in Sebastopol, California. It was an enormous event, and the CPUC was there, and TURN, which is a consumer advocacy organization. And PG&E had hired her and somebody else to come out and counter us. And an hour before the event, they pulled the plug, and then later they put on their own event, which was sort of underattended, but she was there. And we Googled her. That's all you have to do is Google Lika Kaifetz, and you'll know exactly what's going on. Do I know how to spell her name? Do you know how to spell her name?
K-H-E-I-F-E-T-S.
Kaifetz, Lika.
L-E-K-A.
Where she gets her money is hidden. She has a legal right to hide where she's getting paid. She's now got a university post, but she worked for the biggest... industry utility organization.
Electric Power Research Institute.
Yeah, right. Forever. So she works for utility companies, and she's one of the people who are trying to tell everybody that the smart meters are okay. We need to take a very brief musical break. We're going to come back to our interview with Sam Milhaum, M-I-L-H-A-M. He's a physician and an epidemiologist. Sam, do you have a different telephone that you can use that might have a better sound quality?
I've got a... I hate to use it, but I could try my... I got a portable phone which I can put on speakerphone and see if that's any better.
No, I don't think the speakerphone's going to work well, but maybe the handset.
We could try it. I mean.
It's just that we'll have to keep interrupting your interview if it doesn't sound good. So, but you could try picking up the handset after we come back from break and see if it's an extension. You just stay connected and pick up
okay,
your handset.
I'll go get the handset.
Yeah, we'll see if it's any better. So we're going to take a brief musical break from our interview with Sam Milhound. He's the author of Dirty Electricity, Electrification, and the Diseases of Civilization. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and we'll be right back after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I am on the phone today with Sam Milhound, who is a physician and an epidemiologist. There's information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, an hour stream, our archive, CD copies, our book, and there's lots more at our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, with everything spelled out. Information, 707-874-2772, or you can email us at admin, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. So, Sam, do you have a website or anything you want people to go to?
I've got a website. It's HTTP, it's a Sam Milham, all one word, .com, and it's got I basically built the website to promote the book, but it's got links to all the important papers, so you can get PDF copies of the papers that really inform the book, and there's some other interesting stuff on the website. Contact information. Is this phone any better than the other one?
Yeah, it is better.
Okay, well, it's away from my head.
Okay, that's fine. With that, let's go back to this issue. Let's lead ourselves back into the dirty electricity issue. As I said, people have a hard time understanding that electricity, which is, I mean, amazing. I love electricity. I really do. I love it, love it, love it. I love electricity. There, it's out. So what causes, 60 megahertz electricity for a lot of people is just fine. I have no trouble with it.
Cycle?
Yeah.
60 hertz.
60 hertz.
60 cycles a second. In Europe, it's 50 cycles a second. Well, you know, when I was reading this history, I had to go back to all these old death books, these moldy old things in the libraries and online. I went back to 1900. It was really curious that Edison electrified New York City starting in 1882 with the direct current system. You know, by 1900, there was a clear 8-year difference in longevity if you lived in the city versus if you lived in the country. I mean, and the people who wrote these volumes, these vital records volumes, noticed that. So, I mean, so the statisticians and the people who are compiling these records noticed that as early as 1900, there was a longevity penalty to being an urban resident. So I got, and I'm sure that they didn't have a clue that it was due to electricity. But
well, what makes it go bad? What makes it bad? I mean,
well, what's with the 60 cycle? I think from the get go, if you looked at the Edison generated electricity with these huge mechanical devices. He called them jumbos. There's one still that was rescued from they had a fire that burned them all up except one, and it's in Dearborn, Michigan, and still functioning. If you look at how they're put together, you know, electric motors and generators are basically identical machines. In one case, you spin the shaft and you get electricity. The other, you put electricity in and it spins the shaft. If you look at the shaft, the critical part of it is called the commutator, and it's got metallic segments or conductive segments that are connected to wires that are wound for, like an electromagnet, and the electricity or that's made or induced is put in through brushes, which rub up against the shaft. Like you've got carbon brushes in your vacuum cleaner, and most motors and generators have brushes. They used to be metal, but now they're carbon. Now, where they hit the commutator, Edison's commutator had isinglass insulation segments between these commutator segments, and he wrote in his early books about the problem with arcing and sparking. Well, anytime you get an arc or a spark, you generate a pulse, and it's the pulse fields that seem to be very much more biologically active than the continuous, nice, smooth 60-cycle sine wave. So when he was generating DC and then later AC with these arcing and sparking on his dynamos, his generators, I'm sure he was just introducing, you know, a lot of rapid rise time pulses of what we call dirty electricity, which are basically high-frequency voltage transients. Now, when I did the early occupational stuff, we all were led to believe that it was magnetic fields caused by the passage of current through wires that was the critical variable. So we went out and bought magnetic field meters or Gauss meters to measure this, but the epidemiology just never fit. I'll give you an example. The kinds of risk ratios you get if you look at magnetic fields are rarely above 4. Most of the time they're, say, twice expected. Yet if you have a two-pack-a-day smoker, his risks or odds ratios are over 20 times that of a non-smoker. So the magnetic field epidemiology just didn't make good sense. When I found that had all these diseases tied to the spread of electrification in this country, I just couldn't believe it was the power frequency fields. And that's where the dirty electricity business comes in.
Okay, let me just stop you for a minute. I want to get this out in a way that's more simple for people who are not techie. Part of the issue with 60 hertz electricity is the way it's produced and then the way it's delivered. And
right.
what makes it not so good is when you get transients and pulsing and modulation
right.
changes. It's not steady. So it sounds like there were some periods of history where our electrical source may have been cleaner than it is now. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Well, the major sources of this the dirty electricity are arcing and sparking. And certainly I think Edison's early generators had that. But the other major cause is anything that interrupts current flow. And until we had dimmer switches, there were no devices that did that. Dimmer mm-hmm. switches do it. Now, all the junk we have now that use switching power supplies, well, you talked about your little AC wall warts. I mean, everything we use electrically, like transmitters and your cell phones, run on direct current, and yet we power them from AC. So these little devices that change the AC to DC use transistors and resistors.
Okay. All right. So now I understand how dirty electricity gets produced. But I just want to be clear that what we're saying is that it's possible to use the electricity that's being delivered if you make some modifications in the way that you're using it in your house, and also, with some exceptions, depending on how your utility company, depending on what they're planning on doing next, like some of these smart meters and various things. So, but the thing I want to be clear about is that we're not saying that you can't use electricity safely, are we?
No, we're not saying that at all.
Okay.
Point of fact, that we've really crapped up the system big time in the last 20 years with TV sets and computers and cell phones.
But people like to use their TVs and their computers, so how can they use these pieces of equipment without harming themselves?
Okay, well, some are better than others.
Okay.
Plastic TVs are notorious.
Yes.
Putting out high-frequency transients. The other thing you can do is if you can buy plug strips that have capacitive filters built in to plug your TV into. And what it does, these capacitors kind of soak up the dirty electricity.
Talking about surge protectors?
Well, surge protectors have, or plug strips have, you can buy them now with capacitive filters like Stetzer's filter. Like Graham Stetzer manufactures a filter you can plug into outlets. You can. I got one right here in my office. It's a Belkin plug strip, and it's got a high pass filter in it that takes out the high frequency transients and delivers. What it does is it drops the dirty electricity readings in. From my computer by a factor of 100.
Okay, so it is unfortunate that the only people that are making these right now are is Dave Stetzer and his partner, and they have testing equipment and they. What were you going to say, Jeffrey?
I was surprised to find out that I bought this at Home Depot last year.
So it's influenced the market.
Well, the market's changing. You can buy these integral filters built into plug strips.
Okay, and what are they called exactly?
Oh, well, this is what's it called?
Not the brand, just what do you ask for when you go to the store?
Get on my hands and knees and look at it.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Dr. Sam Milhound is on his knees during this interview.
It's called Belkin Protected.
Protected.
Belkin. And then it says, let's see.
Just done an ad for Belkin. That's good.
It's not an ad for them, but it's made in China, of course, like everything else. But when I bought the package.
Well, don't worry about, grabbing this one and finding out how it's described. I'm just wondering if you went into a store, you went into your hardware store, and you wanted to ask for one of these, how would you identify it?
Well, you just look at what I did is I just looked at the packages, and they advertise that this filters out high frequency fields.
Okay, so it filters high frequency fields.
Right, that's what capacitors do. A capacitor has been
capacitor.
Around 8 years. You know, Stetzer just has one that's convenient that you can plug into a wall to knock the fields down.
Fields. All right. So what we're saying is that. We're going to run out of time, so I want to get all of this in. That Dave Stetzer and his—I can't remember his partner's name.
Martin Graham.
Graham and Stetzer worked together. They grouped. They got together and they figured out how to test these transients on the line. So they sell materials, and you can Google them.
Well, Dr. Graham, the Stetzer sells the stuff. Graham's an emeritus professor.
Okay, so you can Google David Stetzer, S-T-E-T-Z-E-R.
A Stetzer Electric website. He sells the meters and he sells the filters.
And we're not, nobody gave us any money. Far from it, because we actually bought some of them and they do work. Or you can get some strips, power strips that have capacitors on them that protect your filter high frequency fields. So
the strips too, but you can also buy them on the market.
So part of it is choosing products that are better. So you said plasma TVs are bad, and now with people
dimmer switches are bad.
Dimmer switches are horrible. Dimmer switches make me.
The lights are horrible.
Compact fluorescences all the fluorescent lights.
Most halogen lights are horrible.
Okay.
I've got one here that puts out just 15,000 units of dirty electricity. Well, I think maybe let's. Can I just tell how I discovered the?
Yes. Now we can go back. I just wanted to get some good news out to people.
So when we moved down to California and bought this condo in 2004. I forget. Yeah, but 2004, and the first winter we were here, there was an article in the local newspaper that my son called my attention to. About a cancer cluster in a local middle school, La Quinta Middle School. So being curious and nosy, the article was really interesting. It listed teachers with cancer, three of them had died. It listed them by name and by type of cancer. And so I just went to the computer and found out how big the school was. It was a small school and realized that the teachers did have a cluster. The article, the title of it was "A Local Expert Denies Cluster." So they had another paid hired gun from the local cancer registry. I don't know if he got paid, but he came over and 23 times in the hour he talked to the teachers. He told them they had no cancer excess or no cancer cluster. So I called the teachers, I called the newspaper, said, here's my phone number. If the teachers are interested, I'll help them. So I got involved with the teachers. It's a long, sad story that the school refused any cooperation. In fact, they threatened me with a lawsuit for being invited into the school and making measurements at the school. And what we noticed was the magnetic fields, the power frequency fields, were perfectly normal in most of the rooms, but that the dirty electricity levels measured with Stetzer's meter were off scale. They were just really high. And so I somehow got the California Health Department to measure all the rooms at the school. Ray Neutra did it, and we got that data. And the other piece of data we had that really made the study wonderful was one of the teachers had kept the classroom assignment rosters for every year starting when the school was built. So we know what room every teacher was in, and we had a measurement for the dirty electricity in every room. We put the two and two together and found out that the longer a teacher worked in a dirty room, the higher her cancer rate was. And it was really interesting that a number of different cancers had very high rates. We're talking 10 times expected for melanoma, uterine cancer, thyroid cancer. And it looks like now the children who went there have the same problem, but nobody wants to look at it.
So what made a room vulnerable? What made that happen? What was it about the way the school was?
To this day, I just don't know. And they had computers and all the electronic junk we have, but the whole neighborhood, the power lines to the school, well, an AM radio tuned off station is a very good detector. And if you stand out in front of the school, the power lines blot out an AM radio, and I traced it all the way back to the utility substation a mile away, and yet I can't get anybody at the utility to do anything about it. There's three or four other buildings, all of which transact with kids. There's a Boys and Girls Club. There's another elementary school. There's a daycare, YMCA daycare center, and they all have really high levels.
Oh, okay.
Dirty electricity.
So some of it's coming from the substation, but some rooms were worse than others. So was were they closer to the power coming into the school or something?
That room had high fields. This room that had high magnetic fields because it was near the power distribution for the whole school. But the hot rooms seemed to be in relation to they had computer labs and stuff like that. So they had lots of sources. But anyway, the dirty electricity levels predicted the cancer risk. And one of the teachers at this elementary school last year got a hold of me and said, hey, we got the same problem here, and they do. And in that case, the problem is from dirty electricity from the cell tower power supply. All cell towers and all transmitters run on direct current, and every one of them's got a switching power supply in the base or near it that takes the line voltage, the AC, and changes it to DC. And in this case, I showed, it's in the book, that I got a nice graph showing that the closer the classroom is to the base of the cell tower, the higher the dirty electricity levels. We're talking up in the 4,000 or 5,000 range.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be 50.
Sure should be 50.
So let me just tell people who you are again. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman on the phone with author of Dirty Electricity, Dr. Samuel Milham, Milham. He is an epidemiologist who's been studying all of this for 50 years, so he's got the long view. Now, Dr. Magda Havas at University of Trent in Canada has been also on our show and has also done a lot of papers and work on this stuff too, and has found that when you filter in the schools, you can drop the amount of dirty electricity way down to sort of a tolerable level.
I got a little anecdote to tell you about this school. When I was the elementary school, when I was dealing with this one teacher, she said one of my friends is going to quit because the kids are unteachable and unmanageable in her class.
Right.
Magda did some studies showing that if you filter the classroom dirty electricity levels, the kids are more teachable. They're not hyperactive. I kind of think that ADA, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder's got a big electrical component to it. So anyway, I visited this teacher and I said, let me say, her room was really hot, 5,000-6,000 units. I took my own filters, plugged them in, and got the levels down to 40. And I didn't say a word to her about what to expect. I came back next week, and she said, "My God, what did you do?" I said, "I just filtered the electricity." She said, "Well, the kids are completely different. They're manageable. They're teachable. They're," and so I said, "Tell you what, let's do an experiment. Pull the filters out next weekend." She did, and she said, "The following Monday, they were back to their usual hyperactive selves."
Mm-hmm.
So not only does this stuff have to do with cancer, it's got to do with behavior and hyperactivity and
right.
Knows what else.
So I want to dial this back a little bit because we've only got about 7 minutes left, and I want to make sure we give people some good practical advice. One of the things that we're saying here, and it's in schools a lot too, which makes a huge difference, is using fluorescent bulbs. And
it's terrible.
They're really bad. We did some measurements in our own home, and we didn't use fluorescents in the house, but we had some underneath the house in a workspace, and we found that even if they were turned off but still plugged in, it made our electricity in the house dirtier and made the fields different in the house in general. So we got rid of them. We have found that some LED bulbs are okay. It looks as though the ones that are really strong, the really bright LEDs, tend to emit some radio frequency that's measurable, but you can also place them far away from you. So you wouldn't want to use a really strong LED in a lamp that's right next to your head, but if you had it overhead, it might not be too bad. But it didn't dirty the electricity in the house. And certainly the ones that are less strong, where you can use more of them, seem to be okay. And they're even more energy efficient than fluorescents. But in schools and in hospitals, where you've got extra equipment and you've got fluorescents, that's a real problem.
The highest levels I've seen, I've measured. I have a special meter made by Stetzer for me, and goes up to 20,000 units instead of 2,000. I've had hospitals and places near cell towers that peg at 20,000 units, and I'm going to have a sleep study for next week in a lab. I went in last and plugged my meter in at 15,000 units, so I won't go in there unless I filter that place.
Let's talk a minute about telephones and chargers too, because that's another thing that people use in their houses without thinking about it.
Well, those little things you plug into the wall they're basically switch mode power supplies, and you're much better off with a landline if possible, and if you have a portable phone, never put it against your head. It's just like a cell phone.
But the base station is a receiver.
Base station, you want to avoid decked phones. Mark DeHavis done a study showing that the base station, which is putting out all the time, can cause certain people to have cardiac irregularities, arrhythmias.
Mm-hmm. Now she's also written a lot about the connection between high blood sugars and diabetes and dirty electricity.
I talked to people at Hopkins and the University of Maryland to study the Amish in Maryland and in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, we're going to move there, I think.
And they told me that one of the big mysteries of their lives is that the Amish have the same body mass index. They're just as fat as we are, yet they have 40% of the diabetes incidence. And I told them it's due to the fields. It's due to the fact that they don't have electric field measurements. They're my favorite population for comparison.
To compare, yeah.
Living control. Now, okay. Before we quit, there's...
Well, there's something else I also want to talk about. So very quickly, what?
I wanted to mention these so-called green technologies.
Yes, I was going.
I've looked at wind farms, and I've looked at photovoltaic solar. They can both be very dirty producers of dirty electricity if they're... Because they have to switch their generated frequencies, AC/DC, to the grid frequency. They're called grid intertie converters. If they have bad ones, they dirty up the grid right from the get-go. I've measured a wind farm here in the valley here by Palm Springs, and it's the worst ground current tracings I've ever seen anywhere.
And that it's important to so this could be fixed if people will listen to the issue of filtering stuff, right?
Of course. Look.
If it's filtered, it's not. And then secondly, it also brings up this whole issue of people putting in their own electrical power, because we've got, coming down the line here, we're going to have fuel cells. We've already got photovoltaics and solar. My impression, because I first met you when I called you to talk about this, is that one way you can protect yourself is to enclose your inverter and shield the inverter building so it's not doing it, and then you put filters on the lines coming into the house. Is that correct? Is that what you do?
No, it's really hard to filter what's coming in. What you want to, they can engineer the converters to give you pure sine wave coming out. Like there's one proprietary for single house solar that I forget the name of it, but I've looked at four or five of them. Four or five were dirty. This one was clean as a whistle.
So this is an inverter?
All of them have to use inverters to make the DC-AC.
Right.
And this one, I think it was called Sunny Boy, maybe that was the name of it. But so I corresponded with some people who'd done their homework, and they discovered this one available solar inverter that was clean. But the others were just terrible, bad, you know.
But if you bought one that maybe was terrible and bad, is there nothing you can do to...
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the best advice is to try to get something clean up front. Another horrible source that's just a brand new one coming in are these furnace fan motors, the variable speed fans. All these variable speed motors
have
inject a lot of dirty electricity into the works. And if you have a new furnace with a variable speed fan on it, chances are it's putting out a whole lot of dirty electricity. It's hard to remove. A lot of it will run down the ductwork, too.
Okay, so let's go back to the solar for a minute. When you get the information on that, can you pass it on to me so I can put it on our website?
I will. I got some of this through City Sage, and the people think I could probably find the email. I'll just forward it to you.
That'd be great, and then we can maybe put it on our smart meter page, because okay. I know some people are putting in solar to get away from the smart meters.
Well, I like photovoltaic solar is wonderful. I think something else is going to save us. They've got a new technology that gets rid of Wi-Fi by using visible white light. They can transmit data through LEDs in the ceiling. Actually, you know, run your laptop. And it's a light thing. It's not a microwave thing.
Well, send me that too, because I may want to interview the people who are working on it. Can you send that to me too?
Okay, I will.
Okay, so we're almost out of time. Do you have anything real quick that you want to leave people with?
If you get a chance, this little book of mine is 120 pages. It can be a life-altering experience if you can save yourselves and your relatives a lot of misery if you pay attention to what's in it.
So it's Dirty Electricity, Sam Milhound, and give out your website again.
Well, you can get it. It's my website, sammilhound.com, all one word. But you can get it from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, have it online.
Okay. Sam, Dr. Milhound, M-I-L-H-A-M, M-D-M-P-H, I want to thank you so much. We're so lucky to have someone like you, especially on our side, because you are a rascal, and you've done some great work, and thank you so much for this great book.
My phone number's in the book, so if anyone wants to call me, I answer my own phone.
Okay.
I give advice.
All right.
Have a nice one.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, a full hour, on our website, our archive, CD copies, and there's lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. Our information number is 707-874-2772, and you can email us at admin, A-D-M-I-N, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.